The story behind the headlines. Every Sunday evening at this time, the National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with the American Historical Association, presents Caesar Searchinger in his analysis of the news. In this analysis, Mr. Searchinger draws upon research material especially prepared for these broadcasts by eminent historians. And now, Caesar Searchinger.
Good evening. As we look back on the year 1947, the outstanding fact borne in on us is that peace appears as far off as a year ago. There have been some preliminary steps towards peace in the signing of the treaties with the satellite nations, but they have not essentially reduced the extent of Soviet control in Europe. What is more, they have not altered materially the relationships of the powers to each other, for the touchstone of these relationships is Germany. The stalemate of the London Conference has shown that the prospects of a German peace are even dimmer than they were early in 1947. Indeed, the partition of Germany into Russian-dominated and Western zones has become the symbol of the political and ideological cleavage of the world. The peoples of the world are bewildered over this outcome of a war against tyranny and for the four freedoms. Reading the reports of recent conferences, most Americans place the blame squarely on the Soviet government, its intransigence and its expansionist aims. At the same time, when we look at the record of inter-allied relations, we see that other negative factors were also at work. That record is becoming more and more accessible through the publication of memoirs by our own and British statesmen. And it is not a record of unvarying wisdom, singleness of purpose, and strict adherence to principle. Indeed, there has been much confusion and contradiction in our own official thinking, both during and since the war. One of the best means thus far of tracing our recent foreign policy is former Secretary of State Burns's book, Speaking Frankly. Earlier facts of real importance are contained in the articles by former Secretary of War Stimson, now appearing in the latest Home Journal, and those recently published by former Secretary of the Treasury Henry Morgenthau, Jr., in the New York Post. Many more details, no doubt, will be filled in by the forthcoming memoirs of Cordell Hull. Meantime, it is revealing to contrast the ideas of Mr. Morgenthau with those of Mr. Burns, and indeed with the present objectives of our government, especially in Europe, and particularly under the Marshall Plan. This is the raw material of history, and it gives us furiously to think. According to Mr. Burns, and to the administration's experts on the Marshall Plan, Western Germany and its industrial resources are the key to European recovery. Germany must be rehabilitated and its industries restored in order to reduce the cost of the European recovery plan. But according to Mr. Morgenthau, our peace aims up to and including Potsdam were based on the so-called Morgenthau Plan, officially known as the Treasury Plan. Very briefly, this plan envisaged not the restoration, but the destruction of German industry and the conversion of Germany into a predominantly agricultural and pastoral state. This was considered to be the only effective way of preventing the resurgence of German military might and the best way of ensuring peace. The idea was simple and attractive enough to millions of people who were unfamiliar with the nature of European economy and the difficulties of survival after a devastating war. That it should have become the official policy of a modern and mature government seems all but incredible today. And this despite the fact that not only the army, but the departments of state and war were bitterly opposed to Morgenthau's plan. The State Department, says Morgenthau, while favoring control of the German economic war potential, opposed the large-scale or permanent impairment of German industry and contemplated the eventual integration of German economy into world economy. Shocked by this discovery, Mr. Morgenthau made it his business to get things changed. He also discovered that the Tehran proposal to partition Germany was not being actively pursued. He took these things up first with General Eisenhower, then with the British, especially Anthony Eden, and finally with President Roosevelt. The President agreed, says Mr. Morgenthau, that, quote, we have got to get tough with the German people, not just the Nazis. So he decided that, quote, if no one was going to carry out the President's wishes, then I would. The result was the setting up of a special committee in the Treasury Department to draft what later became the Treasury Plan, a plan apparently calculated to bypass the experts of the Departments of State and War. The Secretary himself seems to have been tireless in the pursuit of his objective, and his great chance came with the Quebec Conference in September 1944. By this time, the Secretaries of State, War, and Treasury had been appointed by the President a committee to consider the German problem. But neither Mr. Hull nor Mr. Stimson went to Quebec, while Mr. Morgenthau was sent for to present his plan, of which neither the other two approved. Now, the Quebec Conference was an Anglo-American war council with Roosevelt and Churchill as the chief conferees. When Churchill heard Morgenthau's presentation of the plan to eliminate German industries, he became, in Morgenthau's own words, irascible and vitriolic. "I have never," reports the former secretary, "had such a verbal lashing in my life." And yet, after another day and some clever strategy, Mr. Churchill was converted to the plan of shutting down the industries of the Ruhr and the Saar, with a view to diverting Germany into largely an agricultural state. James F. Burns, commenting on this incident in his book, says, "It is difficult to understand how Mr. Churchill approved the memorandum of the Morgenthau plan. Certainly later at Yalta, he deplored a peace that smacked of vengeance. And at Potsdam, he argued that heavy industries should not be reduced to the point that would necessitate financial assistance from other governments to maintain Germany's economy." As for President Roosevelt, Mr. Morgenthau asserts that he was for his plan to the very end, and that his views were embodied in the Potsdam Agreement. Now, here is a strange contradiction that has yet to be cleared up. The Quebec Conference took place in September 1944. On October 21st, little more than a month later, President Roosevelt made his famous Foreign Policy Association speech, outlining his ideas on the coming peace. It was the climax of his fourth-term campaign. In that speech, he devoted a special paragraph to Germany. "As for Germany," he said, "that tragic nation which has sown the wind and is now reaping the whirlwind, we and our allies are entirely agreed that we will not bargain with the Nazi conspirators or leave them a shred of control, open or secret, of the instruments of government. But I should be false to the very foundations of my religious and political convictions if I should ever relinquish the hope, or even the faith, that in all peoples, without exception, there lives some instinct for truth, some attraction toward justice, some passion for peace, buried as it may be, in the German case, under a brutal regime. We bring no charge against the German race as such. We know in our own land, in the United States of America, how many good men and women of German ancestry have proved loyal, freedom-loving, and peace-loving citizens. But there is going to be a stern punishment for all those in Germany directly responsible for this agony of mankind. The German people are not going to be enslaved, but it will be necessary for them to earn their way back into the fellowship of peace-loving and law-abiding nations." Thus, President Roosevelt, in the last important statement on peace aims before his death. Now, does that sound like the call for a peace of vengeance, a Carthaginian peace such as was called for by the Treasury Plan? Does it call for, quote, getting tough with the German people, not just the Nazis? Certainly not. It advocates the reintegration of Germany into the fellowship of the peace-loving nations and, by inference, into the economy of the world. But in case there is any doubt of the meaning of this passage, let me reveal to you that it was formulated, mark this well, by Miss Dorothy Thompson, whose opinions on the subject of Germany were well known to the President and to the people of America. It is an open secret, of course, that many of Roosevelt's speeches, like those of other statesmen, were prepared or formulated by various helpers and experts, though in the case of Roosevelt, the ideas were usually his own. The decisive factor in this case is in the choice of the collaborator, not Morgenthau, mind you, but Morgenthau's most active opponent in this widely aired debate, what to do with Germany. Not only had Roosevelt asked Miss Thompson to formulate a statement on the German peace, but so pleased was he with the passage that he incorporated it in his most important New York speech of the campaign, almost word for word. Was he sincere? Well, he would hardly call on his deepest political convictions and his religious faith in so solemn a manner unless he shared the convictions of the author that Germany could be rewon for civilization by a rational and human peace. Incidentally, that speech was repeatedly broadcast to Germany by the OWI. But at the same time, the Berlin radio was broadcasting nightly warnings to the German people not to listen to the Allies' invitation to surrender, because surrender would mean the imposition of the Morgenthau Plan. Secretary Burns records how he listened to these speeches in Paris during the fall of 1944. It is worth mentioning that the Communist Party of America was one of the many groups here which espoused the Morgenthau Plan. But at the same time, Soviet propaganda aimed at the Germans was singing quite a different tune. For the Russians, while planning to despoil Germany of its industries, were only too glad to let the blame for the spoliation policy fall on us. Thanks to Stalin and Molotov, the principles of the Morgenthau Plan were implemented through the Potsdam Agreement. They became the basis of the reparations policy under which the Russians removed enormous quantities of German industrial equipment, the policy which has stripped Germany till it has become a burden to the American taxpayer and which has retarded the recovery of Western Europe as a whole. The Russians are the only beneficiaries of the Morgenthau Doctrine today. We, on the other hand, have now abandoned the Morgenthau Plan in favor of a positive, constructive policy embodied in the Marshall Plan. Nothing less than the complete success of the Marshall Plan can reconcile us to the tragic loss of time in healing the wounds of war. Nothing less than complete recovery, at whatever cost, can hope to bridge the political chasm in Europe and re-knit the ties which made Europe the greatest economic unit in the world. The first communist assaults on the Marshall Plan have, for the time being, failed. In France and Italy, the strike wave has receded, and the moderate French and Italian governments have emerged from the struggle with greater strength. France, which formerly had been lukewarm in its collaboration with the Anglo-Saxon powers in Germany, is now expected to merge its zone with ours. It has been reassured concerning its share of Ruhr coal, and the rising output of the Ruhr has heartened the sponsors of the Marshall Plan. Another positive factor in the situation is the increase in British coal production to a point where export can begin in the spring. Rising production figures in other industries have already placed Britain far ahead of its pre-war position, and the expected restoration of stable currencies in Europe ought to set that great country on the road to economic health. Last not least, there is the signing only yesterday of the Russo-British Trade Agreement, a token that East-West economic collaboration is both possible and necessary along with the Marshall Plan. Now, as a final cheerful note, let me remind you of an important speech made by Secretary Marshall in London on Pilgrim's Day. In it, he made the point that the difference in British socialism and our economy is no barrier to our close and even fraternal relationship. That remark is of great importance to us and the people of Europe. It is even more significant if taken in connection with what is happening in the rest of Western Europe today, where democratic socialism is regarded as the only answer, only effective answer to the communist threat. It will hearten most of all those governments on whom we count for full cooperation in the Marshall Plan. And now, I wish you all a happy new year and good night.
The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations, in cooperation with the American Historical Association, have presented Caesar Searchinger. Next week at this time, Mr. Searchinger will be back with another story behind the headlines. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.